Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about cancer in pets today. Unfortunately, cancer is one of the most common medical problems in pets, and we will be talking about options for treatment and some new research that may help cure or even prevent cancer. Two guests for you. Back with us once again, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
And also back, Dr. David Vail, a board-certified oncology veterinarian and professor of veterinary medical oncology at UW-Madison. And Dr. David, welcome back.
Oh, thanks very much. My pleasure.
So, what questions do you have about pet cancers? Would you like information on treatments or research? Maybe you could get involved with one of your pets. Like to hear from you, so I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you, so give us a call. Shoot us an email at ideas@wpr.org as well. Are some cats and dogs more likely to have cancer than others? Dr. David?
Yeah, there are certain breeds that are known to have increased incidence for certain types of cancers. All breeds will develop cancers at about the rate that humans develop cancer.
Okay.
So it's a very common, it is the most common cause of morbidity and mortality in dogs over 6 years of age and the second most common in cats. So it's a very real problem, yeah, in our veterinary world. That's why we have several clinical trials ongoing, and we've just launched a website this morning to begin recruiting for a new cancer prevention vaccine trial that's starting next month. It's actually the largest clinical trial ever performed in veterinary medicine.
Wow.
Involving 800 dogs nationally at three different institutions.
And we're one of those institutions.
We're one of those institutions, along with Colorado State University and University of California, Davis.
You said that cancer rates, and we'll get into that. I certainly want to learn more about this new trial, but you said that the rates are about like humans in terms of cats and dogs, but is it going up, or are there changes that are occurring?
Generally, overall, cancer rates are rising, in particular for certain tumors that are known to be more driven by pollutants or environmental issues in the environment, no, like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And Dr. Sandy, you...
Yeah, I mean, I think what I am seeing is, one, pets are living longer, and so we've got a very aging pet population, at least I seem to, as the longer I've been in the business. And we also have owners that are so much more observant and watching their pets. And I think, you know, getting into, you know, that most of the pets that I see that come in, the owner has felt something, seen something. They want to have it investigated. But that's also one of the reasons why we do recommend, as pets get older, you know, not even doing the once a year physical, but probably going in twice a year, for especially for some of the high risk dogs like golden retrievers and so on, which are the dogs that we tend to see as the poster child for cancer. I don't know if you agree, Dr. Vail, but at least
certainly we see our share of goldens, right, but right, there's a lot of goldens out there as well.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
True. And so the signs, you talk about people looking at lumps come to mind, I guess, but what else do we...
Well, I mean, from the general practitioner's point of view, obviously, any new lumps or bumps need to be investigated. And typically what I do is do needle biopsies of them if they're easily accessible and the owner wants us to do that. Sometimes we diagnose things when we're just doing screening blood work. I just had a dog in a week or so ago that had some very elevated liver values, and it turns out that it has a mass in its liver, and hopefully it's going to be resectable, and the dog will go on to live many more years of life. But so sometimes it's blood work, sometimes it's finding lumps and bumps, sometimes it's things like odors coming from the mouth, owners coming in and saying, why does my dog's mouth smell so bad? And on our physical exam, we might find something in the mouth. So it really depends on the body part that's involved. And, you know, sometimes they're palpable and other times it's we have to do some specialized studies like MRIs, CT scans, ultrasounds and so on to be able to find what's going on with the pet.
Yeah. Well, let's go back, Dr. Vail, to the new website and tell us some more about this. And we're going to come back to this a time or two during the show because I want to make sure that everybody hears about how what you've got and how they might even get involved.
Yeah, well, this new trial is actually a very interesting trial. It's a group that was at Arizona State University. Lead investigator is Stephen Johnston. He's very well known in the vaccine world. And many of our listeners are probably familiar with some of the anti-cancer vaccine trials that are being used to treat cancers after they've developed. This is a new paradigm shift, that potential paradigm shift that will be used to prevent cancer, just like childhood vaccines are used to prevent viral diseases or bacterial diseases. It's involving, as I said, 800 dogs. These are dogs that have to be between 6 and 10 years of age, and it's a 5-year trial. It is a randomized placebo trial, that is that half of the dogs will receive the active vaccine and half will receive an empty vaccine.
Likely won't know which dog is which.
We will not know which dogs are which, and then they're followed for 5 years. So these dogs present to our hospital. They're screened at no cost with abdominal ultrasound, chest x-rays, and full blood work. And if they're deemed to be cancer-free at the start, then they're entered into trial and randomized and followed for 5 years, 2 to 3 times a year. Even if your dog happens to be randomized into the placebo group, what it essentially means is 5 years of some of the best medical care available. And if your dog does develop a lump or bump, there's $2,000 put towards the diagnosis and treatment of any lump or bump that should develop in that 5 years. So it really is quite a win-win situation.
And how do people at least apply to maybe get involved in this?
Yeah, so as I said, it's going to be 800 dogs. About 280 are going to be dogs in the Wisconsin area. They have to be within 150 miles of the UW.
In Madison.
In Madison. And we have launched a website this weekend. It's called UW Veterinary Care. There's no space. So UWVeterinaryCare.WISC, which is short for Wisconsin, .edu, which is short for education. And then there's a backslash and VACCS. The VACCS stands for Vaccine Against Canine Cancer Study. Now, you can also find that link on UW Veterinary Care's website, which is our hospital website, and click on the link for clinical studies, click on the link for oncology, and you'll find it in there.
So UW Veterinary Care at?
UWVeterinaryCare.wisc.edu/VACCS. Now, there'll be a link on that site once you read over what the study is involving, where you can click on and then put in your contact information so that we can contact you either by email or phone. Phone is optional for you. And we will contact you generally within 48 hours to schedule an initial screening appointment.
Well, that sounds like great news, and I'm sure you're probably going to get a few people applying for that as a result of the show. Let's hope so anyway. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Dr. David Vail, our guest today, we're talking about cancer and cancer research, what's going on in that area, and every one of our lines is filled, so let's take a few questions here. Vivian in Green Bay up first. Vivian, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Last fall, I took a kitty off the street. He had a dental in February, and he was doing a lot of swallowing, lip smacking. So we went ahead with a second dental because he was anesthetized, and that was also a diagnostic appointment to find out what was going on. And it turns out he had a lump at the back of his throat on his tongue.
Oh, boy.
So they did a biopsy because we were trying to diagnose what was going on with his weight loss. And because it's so far back on the tongue, apparently there's no treatment. and he will be around as long as he's able to eat and drink. Is that the only alternative, pretty much, for a 13-year-old?
Well, it depends on the type of cancer that was diagnosed. Do you have the result of the biopsy that they took?
Squamous cell? Squamous.
Yeah, unfortunately, of the malignancies, and certainly not all tongue masses are malignancies, but of the actual cancers of the tongue, squamous cell carcinoma is the most common in the cat. And unfortunately, it is one of the more devastating forms of cancer. If it is caught early and small enough, there are some options, depending on where it occurs on the tongue. And as you described, if it's at the base of the tongue, which really is the inflow for all the nerve supply and the blood supply to the tongue, they can be quite difficult to treat. And the overall prognosis is unfortunately guarded just because of the location and the aggressiveness of that particular cancer. Again, there are benign varieties of growths that can occur on the tongue, things like eosinophilic granuloma complex, which is certainly a treatable benign disease. But unfortunately, and sorry to hear that, your cat has developed one of the more aggressive cancers that we see in cats.
And the veterinarian, Dr. Sandy, made the right...
Yeah, you know, and I think it's one of the things that they may be able to do to give the cat... at least nutritional support is to talk to the veterinarian about potentially putting in a esophagostomy tube. Cats tolerate them really well. It's a feeding tube that goes through their esophagus in their neck, and that sometimes works very well for at least getting nutrition into the cats if the cat isn't able to eat well on its own. So it may be able to buy them some time.
So, Vivian, something else you can talk with your veterinarian about. I'm sorry for your situation. Thank you very much, though, for calling. We will take some more calls now. Tammy in McAllen, Texas, up next. Hi, Tammy.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a dog that was diagnosed with osteosarcoma back in April, and she was amputated. And I was told that, well, actually the vet didn't tell me because he probably thought I would shy away from doing the amputation. But I had the amputation done. And later on I went and read and spoke to somebody else that had the same procedure. And he said that he had consulted with others and was given pretty much 8 weeks to the day post-amputation without any other treatment that the dog should supposedly pass on. Well, now she's 13 weeks past when she was supposed to have died. Is there anything I should be doing? I mean, I guess I'm doing something right, but is there anything I can do to help her keep on going?
Sure. Well, osteosarcoma is an extremely common cancer in dogs. We see approximately 200 cases a year in our practice. It is a disease also of children and preteens and teenagers, primarily in people. And they actually only see about 500 to 800 cases a year in people. We see approximately 18,000 cases a year in dogs across North America. And so there's a lot of research going on, including dogs with bone cancer, to help treat and develop new treatments for both kids with bone cancer and, of course, dogs with bone cancer. The standard of care for bone cancer in North America for dogs is amputation followed by chemotherapy. Unfortunately, it is one of our more aggressive kinds of cancer with high metastatic rates. The overall median survival with just amputation is about 3.5 to 4 months because metastatic disease shows up in the lungs or other bones. With the addition of chemotherapy, the average survival is moved to approximately 11.5 months, with about 20 to 25% of dogs surviving beyond 2 years. Now, there are several clinical trials for bone cancer in dogs. We have some here at University of Wisconsin involving immunotherapeutic techniques. Unfortunately, those have to be initiated at the time of amputation. So they wouldn't be available for you right now.
Hmm.
Yeah, it is one of the more painful types of cancer that we will see in dogs. And I had an owner not too long ago that had her greyhound with, it turned out, had osteosarcoma, and she was at the dog park, and it fell and actually broke its leg at the spot where the cancer was. And while she was trying to help her dog up, got bit, and it turned out to be, you know, a kind of a horrible thing, for not only for the owner being injured, but then this diagnosis for her dog. But it, you know, the amputation, if I'm not...
Yeah,
you know,
essentially it renders them pain-free.
Right,
yeah,
right.
So that's a very important part of the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But you really need to think of it as two separate diseases. What's going on in the bone, which we can deal with quite easily with amputation. And three-legged dogs do wonderfully. Run, jump, climb, swim, do all the things that four-legged dogs do, unless they have a significant problem in another limb. But then we have to deal with the metastatic disease that unfortunately has already established itself in the majority of dogs at the time of diagnosis, even though we can't find it with imaging like chest x-rays or CT scans. We know it's there microscopically. And so that's why the addition of chemotherapy is the additional treatment over and above amputation, if chosen, of course.
And would that be something that you would start immediately after amputation?
Or? Yeah, generally it started at the time of suture removal, so approximately 10 days after amputation. Chemotherapy is initiated. And then, of course, there are several clinical trials across the nation for this disease because it is so common, and it's a devastating disease in kids and teenagers. And there are several trials looking at novel therapies to address this.
Tammy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Dr. David Vail, our guest today from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Vail, a professor of veterinary medical oncology at the UW and director of the Barbara Surin Comparative Oncology Research Institute. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Have you ever had a pet with cancer, a dog or a cat? Were you able to successfully treat your pet? Maybe you have some questions about cancer treatments and cancer prevention as well with our two guests, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk and Dr. David Vail from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Some open lines at 1-800-642-1234 and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Justin in Appleton up next. Hi, Justin. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. How's it going today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've learned quite a bit about pets and their cancer rates lately, and I've heard that they're going up, and I've also heard that it has a lot to do with their diet. Now, if you feed your dog or cat or any of your pets a colored kibble, it's got colors in it. Well, dogs are colorblind. That color is for you. It's not for them, and it's not good for them. I'm afraid a lot of this cancer is being spawned by this poor diet. Lots of carbohydrates in there with sweet potatoes and other things, but it's something else to talk about. I thought I'd like to hear from the doctor.
Yeah, okay. So what about food and cancer? What do we got there? Dr. Sandy, start with you.
Well, from my point of view, I mean, dogs are omnivores. They're not carnivores. And so carbohydrates can be a normal part of their diet. And the whole like grain-free diet phase type thing is really a fad. In fact, we've got issues right now where the FDA is investigating some of these diets, these boutique-y grain-free diets, because they don't have the right amino acid levels in them. And we're starting to see a link between these diets and some dogs developing a type of heart disease called dilated cardiomyopathy. And so, you know, I think I would love to be able to point to a certain thing in the food or whatever as a cause for cancer in pets. Dr. Vail will be able to help me out a little bit here, but I think there's so many variables. My advice when it comes to feeding your pet is, yes, avoid unnecessary dyes and things, because obviously that's for us and not for the dog. And who wants to have your carpets dyed when your dog has an accident or vomits and there's red dye in it? But there are, you know, I think any food that's on the market that has gone through the appropriate feeding trials where we know that the pets will thrive on the diet is really important. And there are many diets out there that just follow a recipe and have not actually been fed to research dogs. So staying with something that's actually been proven to be a healthy diet.
Yeah. And how do we determine that for sure? Is there something on the bag?
Yes. On the bag, you should see something that says that the food has gone through AFCO feeding trials. Okay. So AFCO stands for the American Association of Feed Control Officials. Many diets will say formulated to meet AFCO standards, which means they followed a recipe. Doesn't mean that the recipe on the other end is going to be as nutritious as it should be for our pets. So that's why I like to actually deal with companies that have fed the diet to animals besides the pets that I'm working with as my patients.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Dr. Vail?
Yeah, I think that the area of diet is certainly one that comes to mind reading the daily news.
Yeah.
It's on everybody's mind. It is actually a quagmire as far as what information is out there and what has actually been tested in with scientific rigor. Some forms of cancer in people, the incidence is higher after being fed a high-fat diet for many years, high-caloric diets. As far as preventative diets, there really isn't anything that has been proven solidly. I agree with Dr. Sawchuk that feeding a good, well-balanced national nutritional brand that's been well-tested is pretty much the best we can offer at this particular point.
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks again for that call. Let's go to Dee Dee in Couderay next.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. Are you guys there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You're so quiet and well-behaved. I had a question about what is the difference? My dog didn't eat for a couple of days, and when she didn't drink for those same 2 days, I was really scared and got her right to the vet, and they did blood work, and they were suspicious that our vet was suspicious that she might have bone marrow cancer, or IMHA because her red blood cells were also low, and he didn't see any reticular signs. So he had her go for we waited a month and went for the abdominal ultrasound, but he was treating her with prednisolone. So I wondered, what is the difference between prednisolone and prednisone? And to me, I know for people, when I have had it in the past, they give me like 10 milligrams a day. She was on 60 milligrams a day, but I guess dogs tolerate it differently.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between those? And then also her liver enzymes just got pegged on the prednisone on the steroids. And then her kidney values started getting high too, but now he's gradually, backed her off the dose. But I wondered about that, and if you tell me the difference, then
mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. Well, prednisone goes to the liver and is metabolized into prednisolone, which is why in cats, because they sometimes get that their liver doesn't handle the drug as well as dogs do. We are almost always using prednisolone in cats rather than prednisone. And we do use it at many different levels. There's levels that we use it for anti-inflammatory effects. There are other times where we use it for immunosuppressive effects. And the doses can be, extremely variable. And so I would guess that when you were given it, you were probably given it as an anti-inflammatory. But if your dog was, they were in thinking that the dog potentially had some type of autoimmune disease and they wanted to suppress that immune system, you do have to use it at quite high levels and then gradually taper it down and do things very slowly for dealing with autoimmune type problems. So a good sized dog, 60 milligrams sounds like an awful lot of that particular drug, but it's actually pretty average for starting out many dogs that have some of these autoimmune hemolytic anemias and thrombocytopenia. Is platelet or blood cell count problems.
Oh, there we go. Dee Dee, thank you so much. Yeah.
Just if I could, when she was taking it, one of the side effects, besides her enzymes getting changed, was that her respirations were sometimes 60 a minute, and that was terrifying for me.
Yeah.
Now she stopped taking it about a week and a half ago. Her respirations, still, it's like she's panting. Not as bad. It's certainly gotten better. But is that something that should resolve over time? And is it possible that the that everything will, all the side effects? The ultrasound showed her spleen was okay. She had an enlarged liver and some sludge in her gallbladder.
Yeah.
Yeah, the common side effects are drinking more, urinating more, having an increased appetite, and panting, okay? Because it's just one of those side effects where they will pant. The longer they stay on the medication, you're going to see some skin changes. The liver's going to get big. We are going to see some blood changes, blood cell count changes. I should say enzyme changes, which is what your veterinarian found as well. So very, very common side effect, especially when you're using it at high doses.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Of open lines, get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tom emailed to ask if you would mention the use of, I think it's NSAIDs.
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Yeah, in curing certain cancers in dogs. His dog Buster was treated at Purdue Veterinary School for bladder cancer, and he was forever grateful for their care, Tom says.
Yeah, sure. The general class of drug called an NSAID or a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, essentially they're aspirin-like compounds. Ibuprofen is a non-steroidal. Certain cancer types can be affected by non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and kind of the poster child for cancer that can have responses to non-steroidals is transitional cell carcinoma of the bladder. The non-steroidals inhibit a particular receptor called a COX receptor, and certain tumor types will have their growth rate slowed and sometimes even regress, although that's in the minority of cases. So, yes, indeed, we do use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for part of the treatment for several types of cancer.
All right, let's go back to the phones and to Randy in Door County. Randy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you. Very informative show. I've got a chocolate lab that's about 3.5 years old that had a lot of allergies, and she's been on a grain-free diet, and I'm starting to wonder, it's been very expensive, the dog food. I'm wondering if that is something I should be feeding my dog.
Yeah, when we have pets with allergies, by far the more common things that they're allergic to are things in the environment rather than food. And when we do see dogs with food allergies, and it accounts for approximately about 10% of the allergies that we see, it is usually the protein in the diet that they're allergic to, not the grains. Although grain can be an allergen for some dogs, I think that Dr. Google has portrayed grains as being the culprit for many, many allergies in dogs, and in reality, it's quite low. If your dog has a food allergy, I'd be looking at either a limited ingredient diet that uses a protein source that is not something that most dogs would eat, and so we'd be looking at a venison diet or a rabbit-based diet, or in many cases, we'll use a hydrolyzed protein diet that it breaks down the protein into little bits that the body doesn't recognize where it came from. And those would be considered diets that are therapeutic diets that you would have to get from your veterinarian. They're not going to be available over-the-counter. The problem with many of the over-the-counter diets that claim to be limited antigen diets, meaning like a single protein source, is they're not typically made in plants that do a lot of clean out between batches. And just like people that have allergies to peanuts, you may be eating something that was manufactured in a plant that handled peanuts. And even though there may not be peanuts in what you're eating, there still could be some peanut dust or something that could trigger a allergic reaction. So that's why we have to be pretty careful with these diets. But I would think that if your pet is on an over-the-counter grain-free diet, your dog probably has environmental allergens and not a food allergy.
Oh, there you go. Randy, does that help?
It does. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And Bridget in Franklin, it's your turn. Hi, Bridget.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. I love your show. You're so informative, and I appreciate the experts. Say, I'm calling about a cat. I have a 6-year-old cat now, and he's neutered male. He's just an indoor cat, and he's been declawed some years ago. What I'm experiencing with him now is some hair loss, and I can have friends come over and pet him and touch him, and there is just a globule amount of hair that comes out of this cat, and I don't know what to do about it. It seems like he's not grooming himself enough on his rear quarters, where the majority of the hair comes out, and by his jaws as well. And I'm wondering if there's something I can do to combat that.
Yeah, when we see cats that are not grooming themselves well, sometimes that is an indication of illness. And I would recommend that you take your cat in for a good physical exam to make sure that there isn't something that's triggering this. I have a cat who's 18 and he has kidney disease. And I ended up bringing clippers home and giving him a haircut just because it made it easier for him. He's not feeling well. And he wasn't grooming, and so he was starting to get some little, you know, dreadlocks and things that I felt that were probably uncomfortable for him. It could just be that your cat is just going through a normal seasonal shed, and we're seeing lots of hair, and you need to keep up with the brushing and keeping on top of it. There are lots of different grooming supplies and things that are available. There's, you know, one of the combs on the market that many people swear by is something called the Furminator. You can overdo it with that and take out too much hair, so be careful. But sometimes just a good metal comb, especially for long-haired cats, will get some of those tangles and things out. If you're already experiencing matting, then a trip to a groomer may be necessary, or to your veterinarian to get some of those hair mats removed, because I've had so many owners try to take them out themselves with scissors and end up lacerating their cat because their skin is so elastic, and you're trying to pull that mat out and end up nicking the cat instead. There are other things that could be going on as well, especially if you're seeing actually areas of hair loss in the cat. We do see allergies in cats, and they can over-groom themselves. There are some different parasites and things that can cause patchy hair loss, and even infectious things like ringworm, which is a fungus that can cause hair loss in cats as well. So, you know, if it's just overshedding, I think that might be something you can take care of, but a good idea to get them checked out just to make sure there's nothing else going on.
There you go. Thank you so much, Bridget, for calling. Tony in Hoka, Minnesota, will turn to you next. Hi, Tony.
Hello. I had called because I had just lost my mastiff that was 5.5 years old to bone cancer.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Curious about any possible things you might know, the causes or anything about that type of stuff.
So it's a mastiff.
Right. So primary bone cancer, as I mentioned before, is actually a very common cancer in dogs, and it is almost exclusively in large and giant breed dogs, which, of course, the Mastiff is. There are known genetic factors that are at play with that particular disease, and there have been several theories as to why it is a disease of large and giant breed dogs, and also in teenagers and preteens, it tends to be bone cancer develops in quickly growing tall, athletic teenagers as well. Some of the theories that have never been conclusively proven are rapidly growing bone plates. That's the area of the bone where the actual expansion is occurring in rapidly growing individuals. Because the cells are rapidly dividing, that they may be more at risk for developing mutations that lead to cancer, microfractures across the bone plate in athletic individuals has been talked about, but never been confirmed. But primarily, there is potentially, at least in dogs, a genetic factor involved.
Oh,
we certainly see our share of osteosarcoma and mastiffs.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Tony, for calling. I hope that information was useful for you. Appreciate it very much. We'll take another call. John in Sturgeon Bay up next. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. So two-part question. We've got an 11-year-old Gordon Setter, and she's kind of bird crazy in this time of year. She still loves to hunt, but she's diagnosed with a heart murmur about 4 or 5 years ago, and every year it seems to get worse, but they keep saying, man, she's going to really slow down a lot. She doesn't. She still just can really go. I mean, she hunts hard. And my question is it okay for us just to hunt her and let that kind of, she'll only go as much as she'll go, and then if that starts affecting her performance, she'll back off, or should we go easy on her? And then the other part is we really have a hard time keeping weight on her during the hunting season. She's thin, which probably helped her hunt so well for so long. She's thin, but she gets really, really skinny once she starts, you know, burning a lot of calories.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the calorie thing is probably the easiest thing to answer. There are various performance diets that are on the market that are meant for dogs that are so busy that they don't want to eat, or they're just burning so many calories, and they tend to be really high-calorie foods, which the majority of our pet population would not be able to eat and be comfortable with. So that might be something that you'd want to consider doing. Always, when you make a diet change, do a very slow, gradual change. Because these foods tend to be higher in fat, you've got to make sure that her GI tract can handle it. Regarding her heart murmur, it sounds like it's being monitored. And one of the things that you may want to be just watching for, when I have a pet with that we diagnose a heart murmur in, where they're not showing any clinical signs at home, we have the owner watch things like exercise tolerance, which you're going to be able to very easily see if she's a real avid hunter, if she tires more easily. Often you'll see these changes even at home, going up and down the stairs, getting a little bit winded. Something as simple as her respiratory rate going up. And I'm not talking about when she's out and active, but when she's home and comfortable and just laying and watching her breathing, her chest rise and fall, you'll be able to find out kind of what her normal breathing rate is. And our cardiology department says when that breath rate starts getting up, you know, above 30 to 40 breaths per minute, that's the time to consider calling, because even though they may not be coughing or showing any other signs, that's their body sign of saying, hey, my heart isn't working well. And so having that kind of a little chart, and there's even an app for your phone that you can record resting respiratory rates for dogs now as well. So makes it a little bit easier to kind of keep tabs on it. There's a blood test that we can do as well to look at the enzymes that are released from damaged heart muscle, and it's called the pro-BNP test. It's a relatively inexpensive test that we will do if we diagnose a dog with a heart murmur, maybe thinking that they might or might not have any clinical signs. It's kind of questionable, especially with some older dogs. And if that value comes back elevated, that tells me that I better send them off to one of my colleagues in cardiology to be evaluated to see if they need to be on any medication to help support their heart function. So that might be something you'd want to consider doing prior to hunting season, so that you're not out in the middle of somewhere with a dog that's having some heart issues. But just because your dog has a heart murmur doesn't mean that they may not be able to function normally. It just means that there's some turbulence in the blood flow as it's going through the heart, and many dogs can live with that for a very long period of time with not affecting their quality of life.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And Paul in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Dr. Sandy, and good morning, Dr. David. Thank you for taking my call. I have a, he's about 10 now, 10-year-old domestic short-haired neutered male cat who just a little over a year ago had developed a tumor, a thyroid tumor, and the UW Vet School and Hospital did the radioactive iodine treatment. The follow-up has shown that there's no problems, no elevated levels and things like that, and then at his annual physical, everything looked good, and so the vet said basically, you know, we'll just do that every year, do a CBC and a few other things just to make sure. I'm wondering if there's anything else I should be doing and or looking for.
Well, the reason why your cat had radioactive iodine was because he had probably a goiter, a thyroid nodule, which for the majority of cats that are hyperthyroid, these are benign growths of the thyroid gland. Radioactive iodine is obviously going to affect the affected gland, thyroid gland, and a small percentage of cats can become hyperthyroid again because there's thyroid tissue left there, and that can become active and develop a goiter on that same, you know, on a, perhaps the other side of the neck than what the cancer, or, well, it wasn't, it was probably benign. I don't know if you, do you want to call it cancer? Is it, would you still?
Yeah, most
it?
Of the cases, you're correct. Most of the cases are either just hyperplasia of the thyroid yeah. tissue or a benign adenoma, which is, again, is a benign form of the thyroid cancer.
Yeah, yeah. But we see a small percentage becoming hyperthyroid again. And so this would be something that, since your cat developed it once, potentially could get it again. And so doing that annual check with checking that thyroid level, a good physical exam to make sure that they're not palpating another thyroid nodule, that your cat doesn't have weight loss or the associated heart disease that we'll sometimes see with a cat with hyperthyroidism. That's really all we do. Once they're,
yeah.
that's kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, actually, a personal cat treated with radioactive iodine and then 3 years later redeveloped symptoms associated with hyperthyroidism, and we had to treat again. That's that. Generally, we get very good long-term results with radioactive iodine, but the occasional cat does require a second treatment.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Paul. Appreciate it. Talking about your pet's health today, we've zeroed in a bit on the cancer in your pets, talking about some of the cancer research as well that's going on with our two guests, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk and Dr. David Vail. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health today. We're zeroing in a bit on cancer in dogs and cats with our two guests, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She's a clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. David Vail, Professor of Veterinary Medical Oncology at the UW-Madison, Director of the Barbara Surin Comparative Oncology Research Institute. So it's great to have them with us, and thank you so much for listening and for calling in. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Vail, I want to go back to the new website and the research that you've gotten involved in. For those who are tuning in, perhaps tuning in late, tell us again about what's going on.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. We do have several clinical trials ongoing at the University of Wisconsin, the Veterinary School for treating cancer. Those can be found, and information on those can be found by going to the UW Veterinary Care website and clicking on the clinical studies link and then clicking on the oncology link. And we have probably a dozen clinical trials ongoing for various cancer types. The primary trial that I wanted to present to you today is actually not a treatment trial, but a preventative trial. This is a new attempt at actually stimulating the immune system before an individual actually develops cancer. And it's a group of researchers that have launched this trial involving three veterinary schools, ourselves at University of Wisconsin, Colorado State University, and University of California, Davis. You can get information on this trial at our website, which is uwveterinarycare.wisc, that's WISC, short for Wisconsin, .edu, which is short for education, /VACCS, which stands for Vaccine Against Canine Cancer Study. You can also find that link on our UW Veterinary Care website as well. So this is the largest veterinary clinical trial ever performed involving 800 dogs. And these are dogs that have to be between 6 and 8 years of age. You can go to that website and click on your information, and we'll get back and contact you. Try not to tie up our reception phones, because we're going to be enrolling about 280 dogs. So just put your name in. We'll queue you up and get back to you within 48 hours. These are pet dogs between 6 and 10 years of age. At no cost to the client, we screen these dogs for cancer with abdominal ultrasound, chest x-rays, and blood tests. If they're found to be free of cancer, and again, this is a prevention trial, so we want dogs that are free of cancer. And then they're randomized to receive either this new anti-cancer prevention vaccine or a placebo. We don't know whether the vaccine will work, and that's why it's a randomized trial. But even if you're in the placebo group, Your dog is followed for 5 years with visits 2 to 3 times a year, looking for the rise, new cancers developing. If your dog were to develop a lumbar bump, the trial also puts $2,000 towards diagnosing and even treating that particular cancer. So it's kind of a win-win from a standpoint of whether you receive the vaccine. And again, we don't know whether it's effective, and that's why we randomize. But if you're in the placebo group, it still guarantees you 5 years of the highest quality veterinary care.
Very good. Let's go back to the phones and take some more calls here. John in Greenleaf, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Larry and Sandy. Great show. I'm calling because I have a 7-year-old Australian Shepherd, and she recently seems to pant a lot, like within the last month. I had her to the vet. And the vet did an X-ray of the heart, and he said it was normal fluid sac around the heart. He did a kind of a once-over and temperature and all that and checked her gums and didn't think that there was anything abnormal about this dog. And he just said, you know, you're wearing a fur coat in the middle of summer and you might be panting a little bit, but to me, it just seems like it's a little more than usual, probably within the last month or so.
Okay. Yeah. You know, dogs pant for a number of reasons. One of them happens to be heat, because the only way dogs can actually get rid of extra body heat is through panting, or they sweat through the bottoms of their feet. And so if your dog has potentially put on extra weight over this last winter, maybe this summer it's just been a little harder for your dog. We'll also see dogs panting because they're anxious. And so if there's things like thunderstorms or perhaps your dog has developed some other behavior issues like separation anxiety, the anxiety like that can cause a dog to pant more. And then we'll also see them panting more when they're in pain. And, you know, we like to get sympathy cards and flowers sent to us and people, you know, giving us a kind of a pat on the back when we're ill. Dogs are really good at hiding pain. And although your veterinarian did, sounds like a fairly thorough physical exam, really palpating joints for any evidence of discomfort, really doing a, you know, head-to-toe physical exam should be done when we've got a dog that's panting and we can't find any other reason for it, is to evaluate for pain. Sometimes we'll put them on some medications like a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory if they check out fine, to see if maybe they are uncomfortable and it might make them feel a little bit better and might slow down some of that panting. So lots of different reasons, and you were right on with going to the vet to have that stuff looked at that can be looked at, but maybe give your veterinarian a call and just say, hey, do you think there could be something else? Could my dog be uncomfortable? Or what did you think of my dog's body condition? If they were overweight, that may be part of it as well, and they may be able to recommend a diet.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Lynette in Richfield, hi to you.
Hi. I've got a couple of older dogs, and the older that they become, the more they are frightened by the thunder and lightning storms, especially lately. I was wondering, thunder shirt doesn't seem to work, although I probably don't get it on soon enough. I was wondering if you had any suggestions, more natural type remedies to relax them a little bit versus medications, and possibly how do you feel about CBD oil?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that you can try. The whole thunder shirt thing actually started, I tell people before they go out and buy a thunder shirt, to go online and just look up something called the T-Touch Wrap. Back many years ago, probably about 30 years ago, there was a person that developed this method of calming dogs and dealing with different anxieties called Linda Tellington Jones, and she developed this method called the T-Touch, and she came up with this wrap system that involved using different ACE bandages and things. I always recommend people to try those before they go out and invest in one of these wraps, because some dogs actually become more anxious when they have clothes on, and or it may not even work. So try the T-Touch wrap first before you go out and invest in one of those thunder shirts. They definitely don't work for every dog, or even, in my opinion, very many dogs. I find that they don't work much at all. When it comes to natural products, there are some over-the-counter Comatives that usually contain a milk protein-based products. There's one called Composure that you can get just online, and a number of different brands that are along that line. There are some things that I affectionately call the beer, tea, and turkey treatment. They are herbal products that usually contain tryptophan and hops and chamomile and a number of other valerian and a number of other things that may help your dog. The problem is getting these things into your dog or your dog treated before the thunderstorm starts. And so you have to be a weather watcher. If there's going to be even a slight chance of a storm, you need to medicate your dog, whether it's using over-the-counter products or prescription-type Comatives. This is truly a phobic response, and I think people tend to ignore it early on. The dog may just have their pupils dilate. They may do a little panting. They may, you know, seek out a hiding spot. But then as time goes by, every season it gets worse. The earlier you start with treatment, the better for the sake of the dog. Always providing your dog with a safe, I call it a bomb shelter, that would be very helpful as well. You know, something that they can disappear to down in the basement where they can't see or hear the noises going on.
Makes a lot of good sense. Lynette, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're visiting today about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. David Vail, professor of veterinary medical oncology at the UW-Madison. He directs the Barbara Surin Comparative Oncology Research Institute. We've focused a bit on cancer in pets, but we're taking other questions as well, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk and Dr. David Vail. You stay with us. Taking a look at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. David Vail as well, professor of veterinary medical oncology at the UW-Madison and director of the Barbara Surin Comparative Oncology Research Institute. We've zeroed in a bit on cancer in pets, but taking other questions as well. And the number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Robin in Marathon wonders if pugs are prone to liver cancer. Dr. Vail, what's the word on that?
Yeah, I don't think that I recognize any greater incidence of liver cancer in pugs than some of the other breeds. The good news is that the majority of liver cancers that are primary in dogs are quite treatable with surgery, and long-term survival is the norm after surgery. Pugs are known for another tumor type, something called mast cell tumors, which as well, 80% of mast cell tumors developing in that breed are curable, or we can turn that disease into a chronic disease with very good quality of life.
Well, there we go. Let's go back to the phone. Cindy in Suamico, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting, Cindy. What's on your mind?
Hello. I have a couple of cats that have been diagnosed with an overactive mite. And I'm treating them with Advantage Plus every 2 weeks for 12 weeks. I've done that twice already. And I'm on my third time within a year and a half, and it seems like they just start getting itchy after I stop the Advantage. So I'm wondering if there was something else I could do.
Do you know what kind of mite they've been diagnosed with? Was it Demodex, cat Demodex? Does that sound familiar?
I believe it was the Demodex, yes.
Okay. Demodex is a mite that we see in both dogs and cats. Unfortunately for cats, their form of Demodex is contagious cat to cat. And so if your cats are indoor outdoor cats and coming in contact with other cats outdoors, they may be getting reinfected with this particular mite. In dogs, it's a totally different story. They get them from their mom when they're little, and it's usually only dogs that have a suppressed immune system, either as a young dog or an older dog that has some other type of disease that's suppressing their immune system, they may have these mites come back out again. So I'd really be looking at, you know, where your cat is coming in contact with other animals if they're getting these mites over and over again. And I assume you're probably using a product called Advantage Multi and not Advantage Plus. Advantage Multi contains a drug called moxidectin, and that is sometimes helpful for some mites. But the kind of gold standard therapy for Demodex gattoi in cats is using something called lime sulfur dip. Larry's had experience with it. It is not the most pleasant thing in the world.
Smelly,
but probably the thing that works the best at being able to kill mites. Although Advantage Multi, it does have some effect. We know that in dogs, it's not 100%, and we can see dogs maintaining their mites. Even less research has been done in cats, and so it's not going to hurt your cat to use it every 2 weeks, but you may want to talk to your vet about using something that might be a little more effective, a little messier, but using this lime sulfur dip every week or so for about 6 weeks.
Yeah, it works. It really does work. Cindy, thank you for calling. Sue in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi, thank you. I have a 13-year-old cat, spayed, female, obviously, who a week ago today stopped being able to use her legs very well. Okay. I took her to the vet, and I, for financial reasons, couldn't afford all kinds of in-depth checks, but the vet guesses that it may be a spinal thing. It's all four legs, but not all to the same degree.
Mm-hmm.
And my cat walks around on her elbows now. I'm keeping her in one room. She's got a good appetite. She drinks water, and she uses the bathroom. But she hasn't gotten any better, and the vet did prescribe prednisone, which I'm giving her, and I can't tell any difference.
Yeah. When you say elbows, a lot of people think that the hock, or like similar to our ankle, would be like the I've had people call them the hind leg elbows, but it's actually kind of similar to our ankle joint. Is that what you're talking about? Your cat's kind of walking flat-footed that way?
No, she's all the way down to the floor.
Okay, yeah. Did you have her screened for diabetes?
No.
Very simple thing for you to do is ask your veterinarian for some non-absorbent cat litter, collect a urine sample, and take it in. We do see cats, and especially when I hear of a 13-year-old cat that's still eating and drinking, maybe eating and drinking a little more than normal. Diabetes is one of those things that can cause a peripheral neuropathy, and cats will often have an abnormal gait and often be walking very kind of flat-footed and kind of in a crouched position. It's possible that it still could be a spinal cord problem, but to have all four legs affected, it would be a problem up in her neck. And it would be pretty obvious. Your veterinarian would be able to do a neurologic exam and be able to tell that the reflexes are off. And there's things that we do when we're doing our physical exam to help pinpoint that it is more of a neck problem versus a peripheral nerve type problem. But I think ruling out diabetes, since that is probably one of the leading causes for cats to have this sudden onset of an abnormal gait, would be the easiest thing to do. And checking a sugar in the urine is very inexpensive. So I think that would be the first thing I would recommend.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Christine in Eagle River, it's your turn. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a 9-year-old Weimaraner who, in the last year or so, when she's relaxed and laying down on her side, will leak urine. And it's I did talk to the vet. We are going to get a urine sample, but she did have a hysterectomy. She had 3 litters of puppies. The 3rd litter, she only had 1 puppy that had fetal demise, so that's the reason for the hysterectomy. I'm just wondering if there are medication options. I think she's a little too old for surgery.
All right.
Yeah. We do see urine leakage in female dogs as they get older, or especially after they've been spayed. It's like going through menopause. You've actually done it surgically. And the bladder sphincter can be affected. And I think it's a good idea to check to make sure that your dog doesn't have any other medical problems like a urinary tract infection or something that could be causing her body to make more urine, which is stressing that bladder and bladder sphincter. So we always do a little bit of workup before we start the dog on medications. But there's basically 3 types of drugs that we use. One that's called PPA, phenylpropanolamine. It's a drug that is not only works on the bladder sphincter, but can also affect blood vessels other places in the body. So especially for a senior dog going on that medication, we'd want to check her blood pressure because it can cause them to be hypertensive. So that would be one drug to consider using. The other class of drug is estrogen, and sometimes we will use compounded estrogen, something called DES, diethylstilbestrol, and it's usually used daily for about a week, and then we get into using it about once a week to help keep that bladder sphincter a little bit tighter. There is now a daily estrogen that is labeled for dogs called Incurin, and many veterinarians are using that just because of the safety factors and the fact that it is licensed for use in dogs and you don't have to use a compounding pharmacy. But those would be the top 3 things that I would consider using. And I always talk to owners about what they would like to use, whether they want to, you know, have something they can be using daily. The age of the dog can play a part as well, because older dogs are more prone to having diseases that can cause hypertension, which makes us potentially not want to use phenylpropanolamine as often as we do in younger dogs, but it is common. We'll even see it in dogs sometimes when they're under a year of age post-spay, but it's more common definitely in older dogs. Probably had nothing to do with the fact that she had puppies.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Question from Mary about sebaceous cysts, wondering if they can become cancerous.
Yes, the vast majority of sebaceous cysts are a benign entity. Dogs can develop single sebaceous cysts or multiple sebaceous cysts. Some breeds are more prone to developing the multiple variety. Generally, they're only create a significant problem if the cyst should rupture. The sebum that is within the cyst can cause a pretty robust inflammatory reaction that can become itchy and some swelling. The occasional sebaceous entity in the skin can actually be a malignancy, but they're definitely in the minority. If this is a problem that is growing rapidly, causing significant problems for the dog, the sebaceous cyst can be removed surgically and or a piece of it removed surgically for a biopsy to determine and make sure that it's the benign variety. But the vast majority are benign.
Carol emailed to say her Roddy completed a splenectomy and chemo for a diagnosis of hemangiosarcoma. Do you recommend anything to give her to help stave off a recurrence, which she understands is inevitable somewhere down the road?
Yeah, unfortunately, hemangiosarcoma is probably the most aggressive cancer that we deal with in dogs. It is probably the canine world's pancreatic carcinoma from a standpoint of comparing to people. It is a very rapid, aggressive tumor that has a very narrow therapeutic window. That is that it tends to progress so quickly that we just don't have effective treatments that can get at it. It sounds like you've had the standard of care, which is removal of the spleen, and then to treat the microscopic disease that's left behind, chemotherapy is the standard. This is a very active area of research because it is such a difficult cancer.
Yeah.
There is some promising trials showing combinations of standard chemotherapy with a simple blood pressure medicine or heart medicine called propranolol. There's some evidence in people with a very similar cancer to hemangiosarcoma and some very early data in the dog to suggest that that is helpful. There are, as I said, some clinical trials going on across the nation trying to find an effective therapy for that tumor. But it sounds like you have done exactly what is the standard, and hopefully we'll be looking at a durable response and a long-term outcome. That would certainly be the hope. We're never without hope, even though this is an aggressive cancer.
No.
Yeah, my own dog had this type of cancer. It was in the skin. He had cutaneous hemangio, and he went through surgery and chemo at the vet school, and we had a good 6 months of wonderful life. I mean, he loved going to work with me, and this, even though he was, you know, spending his day in the oncology unit, he walked in and was a happy boy, and I think when people hear chemotherapy, they start thinking of, you know, their family members that may have gone through it, and help me out here, Dr. Vail, but my dog had virtually like no side effects that I was able to see until the very end. But then his cancer came back and he had issues. But we're using it at, you know, different combinations and things that we're looking at quality of life, not so much as quantity.
Yeah, I think our goals certainly are quality of life and to try and change an acute cancer into a chronic disease like diabetes or kidney disease. Most dogs in general, as you stated, tolerate chemotherapy very well. Everybody's a bit of an individual. So when we are using chemotherapy in dogs, we essentially play it by ear and see how that particular dog does. If they're like most dogs, tolerate it quite well, we may have to make some dose modifications. We may have to give a drug holiday for a side effect. But we're very good at treating the types of side effects that we tend to associate with chemotherapy, like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We have very good drugs nowadays to prevent and treat those side effects. Hair loss is an interesting side effect. It's purely a cosmetic issue, but it's kind of counterintuitive. It's the non-shedding dogs that lose their hair on chemotherapy. So the poodles, the old English sheepdogs, the shedding dogs like Goldens and Shepherds and Labs, they don't lose any significant amount of hair from chemotherapy.
On to another caller, Barbara in Bloomer. Thank you for calling, Barbara. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a 12-year-old lab. He started to gag. He eats his food well without a problem, drinks well without a problem, but just on occasion he will get a gagging response. And I wondered if this is normal in labs as they get older. Do they ever dilate anything? What's the recommendation?
From my point of view, the majority of Labrador Retrievers that the owner reports as gagging, especially, you know, if they're drinking and they may cough after drinking, or they're eating and they may cough up a piece of food or something, the most common reason is that they have a condition called laryngeal paralysis, where the vocal cords are not moving properly, so they lost that protective mechanism of their airway. Sometimes if it only affects one side, you may not hear the typical things like a voice change or heat intolerance. They can't pant effectively. When it's just one side, they often live with it, but it can result in them doing this type of gagging. The way we diagnose it is under a very light plane of anesthesia, we look down their throat and we watch to see if those vocal cords are moving properly. We also like to look down there to make sure that there isn't something else. Sometimes we do see laryngeal tumors or other nodules and things that could be there that may be making the dog have some changes that you're noticing at home. So that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. If your dog does have laryngeal paralysis, it comes down to primarily we just watch them and we make sure that they stay in a cool environment where they don't have to pant and cause more trauma to their throat. And many of them can live with it for a fairly long period of time. What we're starting to recognize now, though, is that many of these dogs that start with this gagging, maybe a little voice change, a hoarser panting, will eventually progress to having other neuropathies. They become weak in their legs. And so we know that it's not just affecting the larynx, it's starting to affect other parts of their body as well. So paying attention for any other weaknesses and things may also help with kind of pinpointing the diagnosis.
And thank you for calling. Roy emailed and to say he didn't hear an answer about when the listener asked about the CBD oil. And I think we forgot to part of the answer. Are there benefits to it?
Well, I actually just went to a big meeting, the AVMA meeting in Colorado, and it is becoming more and more the norm for many owners to try this. When we're using CBD oil, it has a number of different effects for dogs. People will use it for arthritis and seizure control. But the research is still out there. I mean, we're still looking into it and trying to figure out what works for dogs. What I can tell you is that Colorado, they've found that the oil works better than any of the transdermal type products, the creams and things that can be applied. In their research, they're using it at 5 milligrams per kilogram once a day. The downside is many of the products that are available over the counter, they're very poorly regulated, and they may not have as much of the medication in it, or they may have more of it. I've seen some of the owners will bring in some of the vials and things that they've bought at some of the stores, even locally here in Madison, and they'll say a serving is a dropper full. Well, how many milligrams is in that dropper full, and there's no lines on the dropper. And so it's very, again, one of those things where it's a little sketchy that way. The thing is, the side effects are very minimal. When they've used it at really high doses in dogs, it can seem to cause some diarrhea and GI upset. But for the most part, dogs tolerate it well, and I think it's definitely worth trying, especially in older dogs that have, we sometimes use it for pain control, seizure control, even some, people have used it for allergies, and I know that it's even been listed as a something people are using as a cancer support drug as well. Is that something that you're aware of?
Yeah, it's certainly an area that needs more research, and there's a fair bit going on right now. Nothing conclusive at this point.
And I want to go back to the study and the tremendous opportunity that some dog owners have to participate in the work that you're doing, Dr. Vail, relating to cancer and prevention of cancer.
Sure. Well, it's the entire team at UW Veterinary Care. When it comes to the cancer trials, there's many of us that are involved in these trials. You can find the trials on our website. That's UW Veterinary Care, and click on the clinical studies link, and then click on the oncology link, and there's a listing of the trials that we currently have available. The website that we launched just this weekend for a new trial that is starting next month is actually a preventive trial, not a treatment trial. We're looking at a novel way of stimulating the immune system in dogs that do not have cancer to hopefully prevent cancer from developing in the future. As I mentioned, it is a fully funded trial in that dogs between 6 and 10 years of age may be eligible for the trial, and you can find that out on the website, and there's a link for you to fill in information and contact information, and within 48 hours we'll get back to you. Essentially, your companion will come in for a complete physical exam, an abdominal ultrasound, thoracic radiographs, and full blood work. And if it's deemed that your dog is healthy and in all respects and does not have cancer, then it is a randomized trial where half of the dogs will receive vaccine and the other half will receive an empty vaccine. Again, we don't know whether it's an effective treatment or not, and that's why we randomize. But even if you're in the placebo group, you're getting five years of medical care, because we'll see you 2 or 3 times a year for 5 years. And if your dog develops a cancer, whether you're in the vaccine group or the placebo group, there's $2,000 put towards diagnosis and treatment as well, which is another advantage.
So you can go to uwveterinarycare.wisc.edu/VACCS.
Yeah, for vaccine against canine cancer study.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk and Dr. David Vale, our guests today. It was great to have them with us. And take a look at that site. There may be a really great opportunity for you and your dog. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.